Good evening. Thank you for attending tonight's lecture. The Yeshiva University Student Medical Ethics Society and the Center for the Jewish Future present genetic screening, the most important test you'll ever take. As many of you know, and hopefully everyone will know after tonight's presentations, taking part in genetic screening is an extremely important undertaking for anyone dating and considering marriage. In a few moments, we'll hear both the biology-based science behind the process of Jewish genetic screening, as well as the halachic and moral imperative that makes getting tested an obligation for every Jewish person. Our first speaker, Rachel Tzipora Klein, MS, CGC, Certified Genetic Counselor by the American Board of Genetic Counseling, will speak about the details that go into the process of genetic screening and what it means to be tested for Jewish genetic recessive disorders. Then our second speaker, Rav Mordechai Willig, Rosh Yeshiva at Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary, Rosh Yeshiva at the Mazer School of Talmudic Studies, and Rabbi Young Israel of Riverdale, will talk about his years of experience as a Rav and Posek counseling young men and women in this particularly nuanced area of halacha. Please hold all questions for after the presentation. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Ms. Rachel Tzipora Klein.
Important topic. What I want to do first is really give you some of our biological information about what chromosomes, genes are, and then we could talk a little bit more specifically about what, you know, what genetic Jewish genetic disorders are. So I don't know how many of you have a biology or any type of medical background, but basically, this is the breakdown of chromosomes and genes. All of our bodies are made up of millions and millions of cells. In each of these cells, there's a nucleus. Within the nucleus, there are chromosomes. The chromosomes are made up of genes, and the genes are made up of DNA. Okay, so that's just the breakdown. When we look under the microscope, we can actually see the chromosomes. We cannot see the genes when we look under the microscope. We need to do specialized testing for that. But if you look at the chromosomes, we should have 23 pairs of them. 23 we get from our mother, and 23 we get from our father. So all of our chromosomes come in pairs, which means that all of our genes come in pairs as well. So we have about, all humans have about approximately 30,000 genes, like I said, that do come in pairs. And we all have about 5 to 10 genes that don't work properly. That doesn't mean that they necessarily lead to disease or any problem whatsoever, but sometimes they can. And then certain conditions we know are more common in certain ethnic backgrounds. There's basically no ethnic background that escapes genetic disease. Every ethnic background has something that's more common in their ethnicity. So what is the purpose of ethnicity-based carrier testing? It's really to detect couples that are at risk for prenatally diagnosed genetic diseases. And we offer specific tests based on a person's specific ethnic background. So most of the carrier tests that we're offering and the genetic testing that we're offering are usually for autosomal recessive disorders. There is one disorder that is X-linked, which has a completely different type of inheritance, which I'm not going to review tonight, and I really want to focus on recessive disorders. So what happens in recessive disorders, if we have two members of a couple, a mother and a father, again, they've got two, they each have two copies of their genes. A carrier means that one copy of the gene is not working, which is demonstrated here with the yellow circle, and one copy of the gene is working. A carrier is completely healthy, because as long as you've got one working copy of the gene, you're okay. There's no problem. But when you have children, you're only going to pass on half of your genetic information. So the mother passes on half, and the father passes on half. If the mother passes on the non-working gene, and the father passes on the working gene, then you have a child who's a carrier, just like the parents, without any problems whatsoever. If the mother passes on the working gene, and the father passes on the non-working gene, you once again have a carrier. No problem, just like the parents. And then the next scenario is if the mother passes on the working gene, and the father passes on the working gene as well, then you have a child who's not a carrier and is unaffected. That specific change in the gene has been lost in that individual, so no problems. And then the final scenario, which is the most significant scenario, which is why we're here today, is if the mother were to pass on the non-working gene, the father also passes on the non-working gene, and this is when you would have a child who is affected, because this child has no working copy of that specific gene, and they're going to present with whatever disorder it is that you're talking about. So basically, there are four possibilities of what can happen. There is a 1 out of 4 chance, or a 25% chance, that a child will have the disease if both parents are carriers for that same genetic disorder. if you have a parent who's a carrier for one genetic disorder and the other parent is a carrier for a different genetic disorder, that's not going to be a problem. Okay? This is when they're carriers for the same disorder. So just some key points here is that when both couples are carriers, there again is a 25% risk. And while 25% to you may not sound very high, I mean, if you flip it, you say 75% chance that everything's going to be fine, and while that's true, in the medical world, 25% is a very significant number. And that's something that we're very concerned about. In general, again, carriers of recessive disorders do not have any symptoms, and they do remain unaffected. I have many patients who come to me after I've found that they're a carrier, even before I've done the testing, that say, well, why do I need this testing? I don't have any genetic disease in my family. I don't have a child with Tay-Sachs disease. I don't have any cousin, distant cousin with any type of genetic disorder. And I respond to them that, well, that's actually to be expected. Because remember, carriers have no symptoms whatsoever. And it's really only going to be a problem if that person happens to marry another carrier. And even in that situation, where you have both members of the couple are carriers, there's still a 25% chance, meaning there's still 75% chance that child's going to be okay. So the point is that recessive disorders can be hidden in families for generations, and it may never be seen in a family until we actually do the carrier testing, or if they're unlucky enough or unfortunate enough to have a child actually affected with the disorder. And then, of course, if there is a family history of a specific condition, such as Tay-Sachs disease, that will increase the chance that you're a carrier, and the actual risk will be dependent upon how you're related to that actual affected person. So when it comes to Jewish carrier screening, there's several numbers of different types of panels of tests that can be done. There are some centers that test for 4 disorders. Some test for 7, some test for 9, some test for 11. The largest panel is right now testing for 16. There is one other disorder that is quickly being added to it, so right now it's up to 17. So hypothetically, if you had come to me and I offered you testing, I would probably offer you for 17 disorders. It's estimated that, and I think this statistic is actually based on 11 disorders, it's estimated that about 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 individuals of Eastern European Jewish descent will actually be a carrier for one of those disorders. And the whole concept of ethnicity having to do with related to genetic disease has to do with what we call the founder effect and genetic drift. And without getting into too many technical details, basically what that means is many years ago, however many years we're speaking about, some point in history, the Jewish community was basically very isolated and segregated from the remainder of the world. And if there was one specific mutation or change in a gene within that isolated community, and you reproduce within that community, you're going to see it only in that community. If there's intermarriage, that's when you're going to start seeing it outside of the Jewish world. But that was how this all happened, where we got to this concept of quote-unquote Jewish genetic diseases. And it was really because the community was very isolated and segregated. What I should mention is that with regard to the panel of tests that are being done, and I'll go through them in a minute, there is a very large range of severity. Some of these disorders are very severe, often fatal. Okay, you know, a child may pass away age 3, 4, 5. Some of them are more mild and may actually have treatment. So there's a very large range of severity, and that should be something that you might want to ask about with regard to testing is, you know, which ones am I going to test for? The very serious ones, the more mild ones, or all of them? So let me walk you through a little bit of the history of the testing and, you know, why you may hear differences of opinion as to which tests should be offered. So in 2004, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, they came out with a statement which was, they actually reinstated it just recently, and they basically recommended that if you have a couple in your office who are both of Jewish descent or Ashkenazi Jewish descent, you should be offering them testing for 4 disorders, mainly Tay-Sachs, Canavan disease, cystic fibrosis, and familial dysautonomia. These four were chosen because of the high frequency in the Jewish population. So the numbers next to these disorders, so for example, Tay-Sachs, 1 in 25, that's the carrier frequency. About 1 in 25 individuals of Jewish descent will be a carrier for Tay-Sachs disease. Now, in addition to these four disorders, ACOG also recommended that you offer or discuss the availability of testing for these additional disorders. Gaucher disease, which I should note is a more mild condition and often late onset and does have treatment. Niemann-Pick disease is more severe, Fanconi anemia, Bloom syndrome, and mucolipidosis type 4. Now, there's a lot of debate in the medical community about what that means to discuss the availability of the conditions. Does that mean we actually do the testing or we just hand them a brochure? And everybody sort of has a different approach to that. Since that ACOG statement in 2004, there were two more conditions that were added to the panel. They were mainly added to the panel because they became commercially available. And what that means is laboratories who participate with insurance started doing that. And that includes maple syrup urine disease and glycogen storage disease. And then the Genetic Disease Foundation recommends five more of these disorders. Now, these five additional disorders here, we were never typically offering testing for these, simply because they were not commercially available. People had to pay out of pocket for them. They were expensive. They weren't being performed at centers that participated with insurance. What's happened now, actually, is that the commercial laboratories, so Quest Diagnostics, LabCorp, these are labs you might have heard of, they're doing the testing now, and these laboratories are all contracted with insurance, and so it's getting covered. And so now more and more people are doing this testing. And then finally, some of the things that you may want, that we're thinking about and considering in the future is testing for spinal muscular atrophy. This is not particularly a Jewish genetic disorder. It's actually pan-ethnic, meaning it's found in every ethnicity. But it has a pretty high carrier frequency of about 1 in 40, and it's a pretty devastating disorder. Children often pass away less than 6 months of age. It can be very severe, but again, it can range in severity. Some are more mild cases. All of these disorders that I've spoken to you about are inherited, again, in that recessive manner. The last disorder on the list here, just on the bottom, is Fragile X syndrome. That is not inherited in a recessive disorder. It is inherited in an X-linked manner, which basically means in order to have an affected child, or more specifically an affected son, only the woman has to be a carrier. It has nothing to do with the man. And so in our community, testing for Fragile X syndrome prior to marriage can potentially raise some concerns. And I'm not going to address that. I guess I'll let Rabbi Willig address that. But the idea is that there can be concerns that if a girl who is not married yet finds out that she is a carrier for this, there is a 50% chance of passing that on to a son. That can present some concerns, obviously, in the Shidduch community. Okay, and while today I'm mainly focusing about Ashkenazi Jewish descent, we don't want to ignore Sephardic Jewish descent. In that there are some disorders that we would recommend carrier testing for as well. These include cystic fibrosis and testing for something called beta thalassemia. The last two on the list, I don't routinely offer it, simply because this third one, G6PD, is very treatable. All you have to do is avoid some medications and don't eat fava beans. That's basically it. And the last one, familial Mediterranean fever, is also something that's a later onset disorder and can be that has some treatment as well with regard to treating symptoms. Okay. One thing that is important to realize is that the testing that we're doing is not 100%. And basically what that means is, we're not sequencing the entire gene, meaning we are not looking at the entire gene to see if there's any errors in that gene. What we're doing with the Jewish carrier testing is looking for common changes in individuals of Jewish descent. So, for example, for cystic fibrosis, we're looking, the recommendation is to look at 23 different changes. We're not doing the whole gene. And so when we do this testing and we tell you that you have a negative result, it does not eliminate the chance that you're a carrier, but it will significantly reduce it. If you look at the detection rates here, most of the detection rates are somewhere between 95 and 99%. There are a few disorders that do have a lower detection rate, but we're pretty good at picking up most cases. So when it comes to coordinating testing, there are a lot of different avenues that people can take. I know that, I assume that most of you have heard of the organization Darisharm. This Darisharm was founded by Rabbi Eckstein. I think it was probably in about 1980. Unfortunately, he had several children who passed away from Tay-Sachs disease, and he actually created this organization, which if you think about it is really unbelievable. A lot of people don't get up and actually act on what, on trying to prevent this disease when such a tragedy has happened. And basically what he created is this system of non-disclosure. What he was trying to do is to avoid stigma. And it has worked. And he, in the community in which Darisharm is used, he's basically eliminated things like Tay-Sachs. I don't know when the last baby with Tay-Sachs was born to a Hasidic couple. I'm sure there are, you know, exceptions, obviously, but we don't see it anymore. And basically, the way Darisharm works is your blood is drawn, you're given a code, so it's anonymous. Prior to dating somebody, or ideally it's done prior to dating, or if you're already in a relationship, eventually you call Darisharm, you give the man gives his code, the woman gives his code, and you're basically told if you're compatible or not compatible. If you're compatible, you're never told if one of you is a carrier. If you are incompatible, that does mean you are a carrier for something. You don't necessarily have to know. You don't have to be labeled. But if you do want to know, I do believe they will disclose these results to you. But again, I don't work for Darisharm, so I don't know exactly their policies. The purpose of doing all of this anonymously is to avoid stigma. Many people don't understand what it means to be a carrier. And so when somebody is labeled as a carrier, others may view this as a bad thing and say, well, we don't want to go out with a person who's a carrier for a genetic mutation. We would like somebody else, please. So by basically never disclosing whether you're a carrier or not, you're avoiding stigma. Nobody ever finds out. One thing that should be noted is that, you know, Darisharm goes into many high schools and they do the testing. So for example, when, you know, I think I did my testing in like 1993. When I got married in 1998, there were more disorders on the panel. And so you may need to update your panel. You may need to have your blood drawn again because there are things constantly being added. So Darisharm will inform you if your panel does need to be updated. Don't quote me on this, but I do believe that Darisharm right now is testing for 10 conditions. It may be 9. I tried to get an answer for you before tonight, but I had some difficulty getting the information. Okay. The other option is to do what we call full disclosure. And this basically means going either to some genetic center, meeting with a genetic counselor, or to an obstetrician or gynecologist. Some people do it with their primary care physicians, although I might caution you about doing that only because they may not be as up to date with regard to how many tests are available. They may or may not. It's hard to know, but you want to look into that. Basically, you're counseled, you're told what you're being tested for, we explain to you what it means to be a carrier or what it means to not be a carrier, and we draw your blood. It takes about 2 weeks to get results, and then we tell you, you're negative, you're positive, and then we counsel you accordingly. Insurance will usually cover this testing. Some insurance plans do have some rare exceptions that say they will not do this testing if it's preconception, meaning they'll only do it if a woman is pregnant already, which is kind of silly. It's not when you want to find out if you're a carrier. But we have ways that we can code it. We can be crafty. And we basically code it in such a way where the insurance coverage will accept it. I have really not had any problems getting it covered. There are advantages and disadvantages to doing this. The advantages, obviously, is that you're aware of your medical status. You know exactly whether you're a carrier or not. If you are a carrier, you would then encourage your partner or the person that you're going to be dating to get tested. And then we would also encourage you to share this information with at-risk family members, because if you're a carrier, there's a chance that your sibling is a carrier, or your cousin, your aunt, your uncle, and so on. Some disadvantages is, again, the potential stigma. So if you're, again, not familiar with what it means to be a carrier, somebody may feel stigmatized. And I can understand that even if you are fully informed, I can give you my own personal information. I happen to be a carrier for maple syrup urine disease. I did this testing once I was already a genetic counselor. When I found out I was a carrier, I felt a little bit, you know, ooh, I'm a carrier. But I got over it quickly. I realized I'm a carrier. It's okay. It's not a problem. Okay? So, you know, there is also this sort of psychological burden that can be associated with it, but most people don't get too worked up about it. And then there's also that concern of, do you have an obligation to share it with family members? And some people are kind of, you know, what if this other family member wants to do Dari Sharm and they don't really want to know this information? So these are some things that to think about in deciding whether to do full disclosure versus the non-disclosure Dari Sharm approach. If a couple, what do we do if a couple finds out that both of them are carriers? And the bullet point on the top is probably the most important on this page, that you need to seek guidance from your Rav, okay, to find out whether what to do. So if it's prior to a relationship or premarital, you have two options. One is to end the relationship, and the second is something called IVF with PGD. What that means is in vitro fertilization. We take the egg, we take the sperm, we fertilize, create an embryo basically. We let it grow a little bit, we remove a single cell, we test it, and we implant only healthy embryos into a woman. Okay, so basically it's not 100%, but you essentially eliminate the chance that child is affected. While IVF with PGD is an unbelievable technology that is available, it's not such a small deal. It's a big deal. It's expensive. It means never getting pregnant naturally. There are a number of concerns with IVF PGD, and this is where you need to speak with a Rav with regard to what to do if this is premarital or preconception. If you're married already and you're preconception and you just found out that you're both carriers, again, that's the situation where IVF PGD really may be very helpful for you. You're married already. What are you going to do? And then there's the prenatal option is actually taking your chances, getting pregnant, and technically we can test a pregnancy via a test called amniocentesis or CVS. Again, what to do with that information if you find out a baby is affected, these are all things you have to speak to a Rav about. So that's pretty much it. I have some resources for you. I brought some cards. If any of you should have any questions, you can feel free to call me confidentially, or if you want to speak with me after, that's fine, not a problem. I also have some patient brochures for you, just printed up from the laboratories, a little bit more about the Eastern European Jewish descent. If on your own you want to go ahead and read about it, you can go to the March of Dimes or to, there's a great website called genetest.com that you get some more information about this. Okay, and that's pretty much it. And I think we're gonna save questions at the end.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. I'd like to introduce the next speaker, Rav Willing.
When a couple comes to me to ask me to be Masada Kiddushin, just about the first question out of my mouth is, was there genetic testing? Testing, as we heard, it can be either done through Dari Sharam, when the individuals themselves are unaware whether they're carriers, or can be done in open testing, and NYU is joining with our community to help us out. I believe strongly that it should be done, and I came with some chapter and verse. The first sefer I'm coming with me is a sefer called the Nishmas Avraham, Dr. Abraham, in the original edition, is now a new edition. I'm reading from the first edition, Simon Bays and Evan HaEzer, where the Shulchan Aruch tells us when a person looks for a marriage partner, now the Shulchan Aruch has phrased speaking to men, but the same thing would apply in the other direction. A person should not marry a woman from a family of Mitzoroim or Nichbin if there were three cases of either Taras, which is sometimes translated as leprosy, or Nichbin, which is sometimes translated as seizures. The three such cases that indicate it's a family problem, it's not just a flash in the pan, something which is unique. Therefore, we have to worry about it happening again. And therefore the Shulchan Aruch tells us not to marry a person from that kind of a family. Now, we're talking here about what the Nishmas Avraham calls Machala Torashtit. We call it a genetic disease. And the Truvas, I'd like to quote from Moshe Feinstein. He's our main man for today's shiur. In Truvas Evan or Ezer, Chelek Dalet Simon Yud, writes about Tay-Sachs. If a person does not test for Tay-Sachs, he is viewed as, quote, Keskiras Einayim Liros Masha Evsho Liros. He's not being a Bal Bitochen, he's closing his eyes to what can be seen. You don't drive a car with your eyes closed, not Bitochen. Open your eyes. So too here. And he explains further. If Chas V'Shalom, there's a Tay-Sachs child, we heard it's a 25% chance, and it causes so much pain for the child, for the parents, one should not marry in the case where they're both carriers. This is a psak. So you have genetic testing and you then act upon it. I've had more than one case where someone came to me, met a fine young lady, they tested, they were both carriers of Tay-Sachs. And they said, you know, let's get married anyway. And we'll do IVF, PGD, that's the more recent years. Or in the old years, we'll do amniocentesis to check if the fetus is affected. And we'll contemplate abortion, which many authorities think is permissible in these extreme circumstances. And I keep saying the same thing. Why are you getting involved in this situation in the first place? Why? She's a wonderful young lady. He's a wonderful young man. I say, that's very nice. That's what your heart is saying to you. But you have to listen to your head. Your head says it doesn't make sense to get involved in this kind of a relationship. If indeed they're married, and after they're married, they discover somehow or other, either chalila through the birth of an affected child or some other way, that they're both carriers, it's a different story. Once they're married, we have to discuss these possibilities. Again, IVF, PGD, and amniocentesis with a possible termination. In certain communities, there's still an earlier test called the CVS, chorionic villi sampling, where in small little sections of the world, they're still testing at a very, very early stage, before 40 days, which can be much more lenient with respect to halacha. The Gemara says in Masechta Yevamos, before 40 days, the child is called Maya Ba'alma. The limbs aren't formed yet. Nowadays, they don't do it so early because they found that one little mistake by the practitioner could chalila v'chas remove a digit, a finger, a hand, it could be terrible. So they stopped doing it so early, so not that much different than the classical amniocentesis. Now, not only did Rav Moshe say this way, Rav Zilberstein, as Rav Yosha's son-in-law, has the same thing. Yesh liyatzam lo lihinosei zelazu, they shouldn't get married. But he goes further. This was Elazu, Yesh Liyatzam Lizgarish. Woo. Get divorced. Alright. In Koshim Aleim Agarishin, too hard for them to get divorced, we understand that. Well, they should still fulfill Puravu and play Russian roulette. Hope that the children will be unaffected, as we saw before. Either carriers or not even carriers. That is Russian roulette because 25% chance you're facing a disaster. Now, this testing, Rav Moshe adds a caveat. Don't do the bedika for young boys who are not yet contemplating marriage, or young girls not contemplating marriage. Why? Because it can lead to psychological damage. It's before Dar Yishar. It was open testing. So, by a show of hands, who wants to give me a number? When do boys contemplate marriage? When do girls contemplate marriage? It's a fair question. So I quote Rav Moshe. Boys, they don't think about it until age 20. Girls, 18. All right. That's an interesting number. Maybe it's close to the reality even today. In most high schools today, girls are turning 18. They're all tested in the high schools, either Dar Yisharim or open testing. So by the time a girl is ready to date, she already has her test done. Boys are not so organized for a simple reason. In high school, they're not thinking about marriage yet. And then after that, it all it's random. They go to this yeshiva, that yeshiva, Israel, back, forth. They're very often not tested until it gets time to go out, and they should really get tested early. And the truth is, the Hasidim have it right. They test with Dar Yisharim, and they don't even go out until they have the numbers exchanged, and Dar Yisharim lab comes back and says, there's no problem. This way they save the tremendous emotional cost of meeting a young lady, going out for a long time, maybe even getting engaged, and finding out that you're not compatible genetically. Whoa, it's terrible. You can spare that emotional distress by testing in advance. So now in our world, it's not done that way. I don't know why. Maybe you should put it on the why you connect. Should introduce it as an integral part of the system. If they're already going through Shadchan, if they meet a girl in the street, camp, in school, I don't know, that's a different story. If they're being set up by a Shadchan, and you know, they're checking each other out in advance, so why not introduce that as well? I would recommend that. Or, for those of us who want to be scientifically literate, not illiterate, and they prefer open testing, and there's what to be said for that, then, okay. So if they've each been tested, so they can exchange information even in advance. You know, I'm a carrier for X, you're a carrier for Y, and that's no problem. If they're both carriers for the same disease, it's a problem. They shouldn't really meet. Sounds harsh, but I think this is the kindest way to deal with the situation. A very kind way to deal with it. And as opposed to being, you know, well, I don't bring it up, it's unpleasant, da-da, da-da, till later on in the game, it's brought up, but it doesn't come out right. I've been holding the hands of boys who've broken their engagements over this issue. And they first put up fierce and stiff resistance. I got yelled at by the father of the boy. Yelled at, screamed at. You're destroying my son's life. He's happy, and you're making him unhappy. And he broke it up, and he married somebody else. I went to the wedding. The father called me and said, thank you for helping my son out. Okay, you're welcome. But I can understand. These are emotionally charged issues. It's not so simple. So therefore, I believe that this is an important project. Again, done either this way or the other way. I don't have a preference necessarily. It's a personal decision. But if I have no testing, I won't do the wedding. I insist that you do, it's part of my responsibility. You do a wedding, you want to make sure they're compatible halachically and they're compatible genetically. I feel very strongly about this. It's very, very important. And again, where do you draw the line in the test? So, the first group, I think it was 8 or 9, or that I think should be tested. Beyond that, listen, we can't go forever. I'm not telling you shouldn't do it. But the first group of which started off as one, it started with Tay-Sachs, and it gradually grew to 5, and to 7, and to 9. These are the ones that should really be done across the board, in my opinion. Now, our genetic counsel studiously avoided anything which may be dominant. The Dar Yisharim won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and it's a completely different kind of a shiloh. Fragile X was mentioned in passing, and NYU may be testing for Fragile X, even though it doesn't really make sense from the perspective of the other diseases that they're testing for, and from the whole conceptual approach, but I think they're doing it anyway. There, it's a whole different story. Fragile X is dominant. If a person has the carries that gene, then okay, well, I'll marry somebody else. No guarantee of marrying somebody else. It's just it's very tricky. Very tricky. I know someone who had Fragile X, and the young man was interested in marrying her. So I had a conversation with him. I introduced him to a neonatologist who deals with some of these things. And he told him, listen, if you want to marry this young lady, you should understand that the way to do it is IVF PGD, which is not easy, not financially, not emotionally. Recently, after a number of years that this couple has no children, so this doctor approached one of the great rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Osher Weiss, and said, well, what if they can't conceive through IVF and PGD? It doesn't work. Can they attempt to conceive naturally, even though it means that they will contemplate termination if the child is, the fetus is fragile X, could be have terrible ramifications. He said, yes. In this kind of case, he would contemplate it. So, you know, that's the plan B, if you will. But again, the reason why we are not telling the person to necessarily break up is very simple. If they're both healthy and can choose another potential spouse, so why get involved in this marriage? But if one of the members of the couple has this particular genetic problem, so then the issue is, we'll say no one can marry him and no one can marry her. It's also not right. So we're left in a difficult balancing act. What do you do in that kind of a case? It's a very serious balancing act. Very, very serious. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories about this balancing act, which although it's not necessarily completely on point to the Darius Sharm or NYU, but in case of Fragile X, it is an NYU situation. But from the broader perspective of the Talmidim, I think it's very important. As we heard earlier, the eloquent presentation, no one is perfect genetically. You never know what you're carrying, what you have, you just don't know. I'll just give a few examples. There's the BRCA issue, which is an elevated risk of breast cancer. And I'm going to read you a tshuva now for a mosh about Marfan's. Marfan's is a syndrome which is genetic and dominant and potentially life-shortening. I'll tell you one story of a Talmud of this yeshiva. It was a Talmud of mine many years ago. He became engaged to a young lady. He comes to me a bit later and says, you know, the young lady and her mother approached me and said, you know, this young lady has Marfan's, is carrying Marfan's. And what should I do? Should I marry her or not? I said, what do I know? Go look up, do the research. She was a pre-med, went to Johns Hopkins, which is, I think even now, certainly then was the main center. They gave him a ton of information. And he said, Rebbe, what should I do? I'm very nervous. What happened was, and for those who don't know, it's very usually tall, slim, angled. Abe Lincoln is supposed to have had Marfan's, they say. As a matter of fact, I knew the father of this girl, this Kala, who had died suddenly in his 50s, and it was probably the aorta gave out, which is often happens in Marfan's, and it's really a very difficult situation. I told you, do what you want. Whatever you do, I give you my bro. He broke it up. I got an irate call from this mother, and she started screaming and yelling. I said, let me come see you. I went into a situation where I was going to be roundly criticized. Perhaps the young man overstated my position. I said, whatever you do, I'll give you a bracha. Maybe he said that I said he should break it up. You know, maybe he said it to protect his skin when he was being screamed at, and I don't blame him if he said that. I'm here to take the hit. And here's an almana and a yasoma yelling and screaming. They told me the following incredible story. It said, when the girl got old enough for shidduchim, they went to their local rabbi and said, this is too much for me. Let's go to Rav Soloveitchik. They flew to Boston, the mother with the rabbi, and the rabbi said, you don't have to say anything. You need not say anything. Just get married. Don't worry about it. So they got engaged and she didn't say anything. Then the mother said, I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't sleep in Hakka. It's not fair. So I told him. And look what I get. I'm so nice, I tell him, and he breaks it up. I said to him nicely, why'd you tell him? To give him the chance to break it up. If he wanted to. So he did it. She was very irate. I don't blame her. She was upset. In the interim, he got married. I believe she got married. I hope they're happy. So, what the Rav said sounds radical, but if you look in the Kilos Yaakov of the stipler and Yevamos, it's a similar situation. Somebody had a certain illness. They said, don't tell. What do you mean, don't tell? It's against everything we learned in the Masechta Bava Metzia, the Sugyos of Ono and Mum, Mekach Tos, you have to tell everybody. So the stipler has a remarkable insight. He said, you know, if you want to sell somebody a car or a house, you must divulge every small blemish. You know why? For the same money, you can buy a different house and a different car without the blemish. So if you don't tell him, you're in violation of Ono, and it could even be rise to the level of Mekach Tos, a mistaken acquisition, quite easily. It's not the same by Shiduchim. By Shiduchim, we cannot say, we have Reuven. Anyone in this room named Reuven? Good. So we have Reuven. So Reuven is a fine young man, but he has a certain illness. So, says the stipler, if he does tell the girl can't turn, okay, Reuven, I don't want to meet you. I want to meet Shimon, who's exactly the same as you. Anyone named Shimon? Exactly, good. Exactly the same as you, minus this illness. There is no such person on the globe. There are no clones in this world. Therefore, because of the uniqueness of every human being, we have a different standard. So what is the standard? Can you, is there anything you have to divulge? Yes, writes the stipler. Anything which is so serious that if a couple would get divorced upon discovering it afterwards, the one would get divorced, then you have to reveal it in advance. That's a very high bar. I don't think someone would get divorced over Marfans. Therefore, the Rav's Pesach is consistent with what the stipler said. How did the stipler know it? Let's do it himself, the Yevamos. Gemara Yevamos, around Daf Memhei, tells us there was a man whose father was not Jewish and his mother was Jewish. Couldn't find a shidduch. No one to marry him. He didn't come from a good family. So he was told, go hide, go far away, but they don't know your yichus, and get married. He asks the stipler, how do you do that? You're fooling the girl. She thinks your father is who knows what, and he's really a non-Jewish person. See from here that for the purpose of a shidduch, you don't have to reveal every blemish. I was told that the stipler's mechutin, Rav Eliashiv Shlita, disagrees and says you cannot compare a father being a non-Jew, which is something extrinsic, external, to an illness which is internal, intrinsic. And if you would have to reveal it. My position is somewhere in between. I think it has to be revealed, but not at the very outset. You could wait a while. How much is a while? So my answer is halfway through. Of course, it's like a half-life. You never know what halfway through is. It depends what kind of circles you come from. I guess if you're a chassid, after 3 days, you have to reveal it already. And if you're in YU, you can certainly wait a month or two, and maybe even more in certain parts of our yeshiva. Whatever you consider the halfway point, that's when it should be revealed. In my own community in Riverdale, I had a couple of situations where there was diabetes in the family. Two brothers, diabetics. I told them both the same thing. Don't send them halfway through. They both, Baruch Hashem, are married, with many children. We hope that they'll live normal lifespans, and each time the young lady was informed, said okay, she went out an emotional attachment, but had she said up front the diabetic, they might have walked away in the first place. It's a very difficult and delicate balance. I had a case just now. A woman has something called Turner syndrome. It's a serious problem, the lack of eggs, of viable eggs, and the young man was told about it. We went back and we went forth, and he decided to break it up. That's his choice. Hopefully someone else will decide to marry her, even though she likely will not be able to have her own genetic children. They have to have donor eggs, which is not so simple. I know a case where somebody married a woman knowing she had Turner syndrome, and they have a number of children, which she threw a donor egg. So it's a personal decision. I can't tell someone what to do over here in these cases. But if you think that I'm being too liberal, if you will, in lack of disclosure, what do you mean? How can you do such a thing? How can you not disclose when at the end of the day you're costing somebody 6 weeks of going out with this boy or girl? At the end of the day, they hear this, they drop a ton of bricks on them, and then they break it up. You give you 6 weeks of emotional ups and now downs. It's not fair. So if you think that I'm radical, I brought another tshuva, which is not, this is all Mishnah Savram, more or less. This is only in the Igros Moshe original. Eben Ezer, Chelek Gimel. Those are mostly from Chelek Dalet. This is an incredible, to me it's an incredible tshuva. Chelek Gimel, Simen Chav Zayin. A woman who's 20 years old, no period. Zero. Has not a period. She's 20 years old. So, some doctors say she can have children. May the father marry her off without revealing this fact to the potential chassan. Moshe goes quoting Gemaras and Rishonim, all kinds of things of this nature. Very nice Gemaras and Rishonim, but I don't want to know tachlis, could she have kids or not? Not so simple. So Moshe concludes, yes, she's Ru'uya Be'etzim Lebonim. She can have children. May take a little while, but she can have children. Therefore, no need to reveal it. But you know what? Just to play it safe, the last four lines. The father and the girl should reach a joint decision that if 4 years will pass and she'll still have no period and she will not be able to conceive, she would accept a get without any problems, without any claims. So then, this is a remarkable line. Once that's done, shuv lo yia lahanosa kim'at shum hefseid. The one who marries her will almost have lost nothing. Huh? What? You're talking about 6 weeks, you went out with a girl and you found out she has Turner's or a boy has diabetes, whatever. He had 4 years and now you're a divorced man. 4 years later, you lost almost nothing. What's Rav Moshe talking about? Lost almost nothing. Here's the answer. Rav Moshe is sensitive to the needs of this girl. It's a balancing act. What are you going to do? If you don't tell, she can get married. If you tell her, Rav Moshe's afraid that no one's going to want to marry her. I don't know. I'm not sure if this psak would fly by all the rabbonim. Again, determine the reality. The Moshe's with a very optimistic prognosis, she'd have kids. But, you know, not so simple. I'm just mentioning to show you the length to which our great rabbis are going to balance out the needs of a private citizen where there's an issue which cannot be solved by merely going to Dar Yisharim and avoiding recessive diseases. So, I will conclude my formal remarks, leave some time for questions before Ma'ariv. I want to thank you all for coming. I want to reiterate that it's important that you all be tested. Nothing wrong with being tested now. They're coming around next week for NYU. I think it's free, if I'm not mistaken. We Jews like freebies. That's true. And Dar Yisharim is also a possibility. Do it. You won't be sorry. And avoid marrying someone with whom there's an incompatibility genetically, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should bless you all to have wonderful, healthy families. Thank you for listening.
If there are questions, please raise your hand and speak loudly and address to whom you'd like to ask your question to. Question? Okay.
Yeah. What is your opinion about doing the carrier testing once you're married, or updating your panel once you're married?
That's an excellent question. I'll speak personally. when my children became of marriageable age, my wife and I went for the whole battery of tests. First we did Tay-Sachs, then I think we went up to 7 or 9. We went to Einstein, that's where we went. And we thank God, for those, I don't know, 7 or 9, I forgot what it was at the time, we were completely clean, all of us, both of us. If we're both clean, according to science, except for some fluky mutation, which is a much less of a chance than any of those statistics, our kids are all clean. So it was very, very relieving to us that we didn't have to worry about it. You always have to worry, you always want to worry about it, but from this perspective. So I'm not opposed to testing at a later stage. Of course, the time that my wife and I tested, we weren't having more children. A couple that's just married and wants to be tested, I think they should still test. I'm a big believer in knowledge. I think knowledge is good. What will they do if they have a problem? We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. We'll talk about the possibilities again of IVF, PGD, and of termination in certain very serious situations. Termination is not, from my perspective, an absolute prohibition. Yes, it's prohibited. It's a Torah prohibition. I'm not making light of it. But in the court, the most authority is not murder. It's not Ritzicha. Moshe has a children to the country, but most poskim assume it's not considered to be murder. And if it may be done in certain extreme cases, such as Tay-Sachs and the like, and maybe even those who talk about it, with this, even with respect to German measles, and with respect to Downs, and with respect to all kinds of things. I'm not giving any wholesale heterim in those cases. But it can be considered, and I think testing would be appropriate at any stage. Yes?
Question for Mrs. Stein.
Sure.
If the guy did NYU and the girl did Dorisha or vice versa, is there still they still match up?
So to my knowledge, Dorisha will not tell you if you're compatible or not compatible, or test you if one member of the couple knows their status. They will not tell you. They will not do the testing. So both members have to do the non-disclosure method. That's their policy.
Bottom line, have to do NYU.
Right. So once you have decided to do the full disclosure method, your potential partner has to do it that way as well. Unless you go to Dari Sharm and they don't happen to ask you, but now I'm telling you, so I don't know if that's lying. So.
What about doing it the other way around? Dari Sharm first.
Well, that you could do. I mean, I did that. You could do Dari Sharm, and then once I got into the field, I said, hey, I want to know my results.
That's also what I did, but I was...
Yeah, I mean, you could
okay.
Do that. There's nothing wrong with that, yeah.
The IVF PGD, is that available for all of the genetic disorders which they test for?
Yes.
They can test them and pick the for all?
Yes. Yes. It's not 100%, but it's like 95 to 99%. But again, keep in mind, it's incredibly expensive. And besides all the other emotional aspects to it, I mean, there is a wonderful, I mean, if you should know anybody who's married already and in this situation, there is a wonderful organization, Bone Olam, which pays for IVF PGD. They just hand you the money. I've sent many patients there. I've gotten genetic testing done for patients like that. So, I mean, the financial aspect of it, you know, could be addressed. But it's challenging doing IVF PGD. And it also means never having children naturally, if that's the route you choose, which also means that never having the possibility of getting pregnant naturally. So even if you're not trying to get pregnant naturally, you need to have some type of protection.
When exactly are those organizations coming around?
NYU will be this upcoming Tuesday and Wednesday. We have the sign-up sheets. We'll be available after this and through the next week. And Dorisha Sharim, we're working on, so give us the information. We'll send an email out regarding when that will take place.
I think that clock is wrong. So if you want to go to Marriott.
Yeah, I have the clock. Or we can dive in here. Just about
that. If anybody was inspired by the speech, Kids of Cards is having a Shabbaton in Lawrence this weekend. They're going to see what it is like living with people who have these diseases. I would highly encourage people to stop by. I think it's going to be in Seven Park and go through Sunday. So, just.
Any other questions?
We're gone.
Right, so.
I think I can think of them at Tanis Kleinman and Rav Willig. And should we?